Welcome back to EVR 2858. We are now in Lecture 5. This is an overview of environmental law relevant to wetlands. By the end of this lecture, you should be able to describe a list of 5 of the 11 different types of wetlands in Florida. An overview of 3 of the 10 different federal legislation relevant to wetlands and why you might run into these legislation in real practice. 1 insect, 1 bird, and 1 mammal that are listed as endangered species residing in the Everglades. Which piece of federal legislation created the National Wildlife Refuge System? Which piece of federal legislation encompasses the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan? And Florida's plans for mitigating wetland loss. Well, first off, what is a wetland? Webster's Dictionary for Wetland says swamps or marshes. An area of land characterized by swamps, marshes, etc., that is a preserve for wildlife. Webster's Dictionary for Swamp. A piece of wet, spongy land that is permanently or periodically covered with water, characterized by growths of shrubs and trees, marsh, bog. What do you think of when you hear the word swamp? What about bog, fen, slough, moor, mire, marsh, morass, quagmire? Do these words conjure a positive or a negative image? How would you define the term wetland? Well, let's take a look at the international perspective with the Ramsar Convention of 1971. So in 1971 in Ramsar, Iran, a group of nations came together and signed the Convention on Wetlands. Today, there are 150 signatory nations, including the United States, who have designated 2,400 sites covering a total of 250 million hectares. When a nation signed on to the Ramsar Convention, that nation had to designate at least one wetland as a wetland of international significance. The Ramsar classification system has 3 main broad categories under which the more specific habitat types are listed. There are 3 classifications: marine coastal, inland, and human-made. It is interesting to note that Ramsar makes a distinction about whether a wetland was human-made or not. How does the U.S. define wetlands? Well, that depends on the agency. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers defines wetlands as areas that are inundated or saturated by surface or groundwater at a frequency and duration sufficient to support, and that under normal circumstances do support, a prevalence of vegetation typically adapted for life in saturated soil conditions. Wetlands generally include swamps, marshes, bogs, and similar areas. Now, why do we care about the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers? Because the Corps administers Section 404 of the Clean Water Act relating to fill and dredge materials in navigable waterways, as I mentioned in Lecture 4. So, what's on the edges of waterways but wetlands? Then we have the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. It makes sense that we have the USFWS as a specific government agency that deals with wetlands. These are the folks who protect animals and aquatic life that depend on wetlands for not only food and shelter, but as breeding areas. So we have the National Wetlands Inventory definition. Wetlands are lands transitional between terrestrial and aquatic systems where the water table is usually at or near the surface or the land is covered by shallow water. For purposes of this classification, wetlands must have one or more of the following 3 attributes. 1, at least periodically, the land supports predominantly hydrophytes. 2, the substrate is predominantly undrained hydritic soil. And 3, the substrate is non-soil and is saturated with water or covered by shallow water at some time during the growing season of the year. This is out of Classification of Wetlands and Deepwater Habitats of the United States by Cowden Lewis et al. From 1979. For further research, you can take a look at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's National Wetlands Inventory at that website. All right, so what about Florida? Well, Florida is one big aquifer, as was noted in our discussions of the Clean Water Act. With so much water, it only stands to reason we might have a few waterlogged areas around here. This could be the reason that Marjorie Stoneman Douglas titled her work River of Grass. So the Florida definition of wetlands is in Florida Statute Section 373.019, subsection 22. Those areas that are inundated or saturated by surface water or groundwater at a frequency and a duration sufficient to support, and under normal circumstances do support, a prevalence of vegetation typically adapted for life in saturated soils. Soils present in wetlands generally are classified as hydritic or alluvial, or possess characteristics that are associated with reducing soil conditions. The prevalent vegetation in wetlands generally consists of facultative or obligate hydrophytic macrophytes that are typically adapted to areas having soil conditions described above. These species, due to morphological, physiological, or reproductive adaptations, have the ability to grow, reproduce, or persist in aquatic environments or anaerobic soil conditions. Notice how Florida's definition starts out mirroring the Army Corps' definition, but then gets much more specific. Now, Florida wetlands generally include swamps, marshes, bayheads, bogs, cypress domes and strands, sloughs, wet prairies, riverine swamps and marshes, hydritic seepage slopes, tidal marshes, mangrove swamps, and other similar areas. The numbers highlighted here correspond to the pictures in the JPEG, and these pictures are just examples. The Florida definition is pretty specific considering we're dealing with only subtropical areas. It covers soil types, vegetation types, as well as common names for wetlands. Florida wetlands generally do not include longleaf or slash pine flatwoods with an understory dominated by palmetto. So, wetlands in Florida. The picture above shows how prevalent wetlands are in Florida. You may not see yellow, but it is there on the fringes of South Florida, as that is where the mangrove swamps are. The slide below shows that the river of grass looks like in the past, the yellow spots on the green background, and what it looks like today, black spots on the white background. Notice the difference. What about salt marshes? And where are the general Florida swamps located? Just a few places there. Now for mangroves. This map here shows the mangrove areas better than the above one. There are over 60 types of mangroves worldwide. The most common ones in Florida are red, white, and black. Red mangroves have the highest water level variability. This can be a few feet difference over the course of the year. Black mangroves have the least water level variability, by only a few inches between wet and dry seasons. White mangroves fall in between red and black. All right, so legal protections. Now that we have a general idea of what a wetland is, how are wetlands protected, legally speaking? We'll go through the various pieces of legislation from more general to more specific. Federal legislation related to wetlands. There are at least 10 pieces of federal legislation that have relevance to wetlands. We'll follow this with a brief description of their relevance to this lecture. There is the National Environmental Policy Act, the Coastal Zone Management Act, the Endangered Species Act, the Emergency Wetlands Resources Act, the National Flood Insurance Act, the Coastal Barrier Resources Act, the Fish and Wildlife Coordination Act, the Clean Water Act, the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, and Water Resources Development Act. Why do we do this, and are you ever likely to run across these? When undertaking some type of regulatory exercise, say an EIS, you have to be able to show that you've done a cross-check with other types of relevant legislation, such as the list above, and that things are compatible with them, or that you've undertaken steps to create compatibility. Hold up there, Prof. Time. We're looking at 10 different laws. Isn't there just one law that protects wetlands like there is for water or air? No. There is a book from Mercer Law School on wetlands law. Yes, indeed, an entire course dedicated to understanding the hydrogeomorphic classifications of wetlands, the laws that have impacted wetlands historically, and what the current status of laws and court cases impacting wetlands today. So let's go back and look at National Environmental Policy Act. 42 U.S.C. Section 4. 3, 2, 1, et sequentia. As previously discussed, all federal agencies are charged with examining the potential environmental impacts of any proposed actions. NEPA also requires in Section 201, the President shall transmit to the Congress annually, beginning July 1st, 1970, an environmental quality report, hereinafter referred to as the report, which shall set forth, one, the status and condition of the major natural, man-made, or altered environmental classes of the nation, including but not limited to the air, the aquatic, including marine, estuarian, and freshwater, and the terrestrial environment, including but not limited to the forest, dryland, wetland, range, urban, suburban, and rural environment. So, environmental impact statements are needed for projects impacting wetlands. Remember, NEPA can be considered as the Stop and Think About Nature Act. We have the Coastal Zone Management Act from 1972. Pause and read. And we're back. So, the Coastal Zone Management Act, CZMA, primarily administered by the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, is there to promote development in the coastal zone areas. But applies a national perspective rather than trying to hoard resources at just the local level. But note that subsection K says, let's be careful about possible pollution problems that always seem to arise due to coastal zone usage so we can preserve the zone for continued use and revenue gathering by protecting it from pollution degradation. This legislation uses a carrot and stick approach, whereby the federal government will provide the state governments monetary assistance to create and sustain state programs protecting shorelines. This not only affects those states with borders on the Atlantic Ocean, the Pacific Ocean, or the Gulf of Mexico, it also includes states with borders on the Great Lakes and some rivers like the Mississippi River. Any project to be undertaken within a coastal management zone, such as offshore oil drilling, must have not only a federal lease, but also conform to the appropriate state's federally approved coastal management program. Question: does the CZMA have relevance to the recent offshore drilling debate? A Google search for CZMA drilling yields thousands of hits. Offshore drilling issues intersect with CZMA first, depending on whether the proposed area is in the coastal zone, defined as up to 3 miles offshore of the coastline, followed by a determination of whether the proposed activity is consistent. What about the offshore drilling proposals that have been in the news the past few years? Florida's protected, right? We were promised that there would be no drilling off the coast of Florida, and who cares about any other state? Here's an interesting interactive map of oil and gas wells in Florida by the American Geosciences Institute. Okay, this is interesting, but not specifically relevant to wetlands. Next is the Endangered Species Act. How does the ESA cover wetlands, you may ask? Let's recall that the ESA requires interagency cooperation to review any federal action that might jeopardize an endangered or threatened species directly through hunting, trapping, harming, or harassing a species, or indirectly through destruction of the natural habitat of the species, especially if there is a designated critical habitat for that species. In the Everglades wetlands, there is designated critical habitat for the Everglades snail kite and the Cape Sable seaside sparrow. Here is a JPEG that shows a few of the endangered and threatened species that inhabit Florida, specifically the Everglades. So there are the key deer, the Lower Keys rabbit, the Florida scrub jay, which I still haven't seen, Shouse swallowtail butterfly, and the American crocodile. Then there's the Emergency Wetlands Resources Act of 1986, 16 U.S.C. sections 3901 to 3932. It directs the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to map wetlands, conduct wetland status and trend studies, and disseminate the information produced to create and update the National Wetlands Priority Conservation Plan. And as part of the NWPCP, the FWS created the National Wetlands Inventory Program that produces information on the characteristics, extent, and status of the nation's wetlands and deep water habitat. You may note that the Fish and Wildlife's definition of wetlands above comes from the National Wetlands Inventory List. The EWRA was the motivating force for Cowardin and Company to do their study and create their classification system. we've got the National Flood Insurance Act of 1968. Here is a law that most of you would not think has any effect on wetlands, the National Flood Insurance Act. The National Flood Insurance Act encourages states to create federally approved floodplain management programs in order to provide landowners within floodplains with subsidized flood insurance. The program includes restrictions on the type and location of new and rebuilt construction within floodplains, which commonly fall within, wetland areas. There isn't a piece of legislation with a large impact on wetland issues, but it does have some slight relevance here. How? With more and more flooding across the country, the federal government, states, and localities are looking to buy out plans to try to take people and their homes out of flood-prone areas in order to reduce the costs of rebuilding. As of November 2018, and remember, we've been stuck in COVID for 3 years, so we've got some older number here, campers. The NFIA was over $20 million in the hole, without accounting for Hurricanes Florence and Michael. After Hurricane Harvey, a huge push occurred to use the NFIA to have buyout programs for houses that have repeatedly flooded instead of repeatedly paying to rebuild. For more information about this, I point you to the Wall Street Journal's article by Ruth Simon. On May 16, 2018, Representative Earl Blumenauer, Democrat of Oregon, introduced a bill, H.R. 5846, entitled Promoting Flood Risk Mitigation Act. Part of the purpose of this bill was to require the Comptroller General of the United States to conduct a study regarding the buyout practices of the Federal Emergency Management Agency and for other purposes. It was passed in the House but died in committee in the Senate. Why should we care about this failed piece of legislation? Because it directed the Congressional Budget Office to come up with an accounting of the impacts flooding events were having on the country's economy and attempt to promote a larger buyout program to lessen the cost of rebuilding in flood-prone areas. The USA Today published an article in November 2018 that stated that U.S. flood-related damage totals more than $750 billion since 2000. Why am I giving information that's a few years old? Because we have basically been on hold for the past 3 years with COVID, and the legislative focus has mainly been to deal with the medical health of the nation and, of course, massive political discord. To let y'all know, I am just pointing to one piece of legislation here, but the NFIA has been amended and I am including information from those amendments. If you want to take a look at the original law and all the updates, I send you to the Federal Emergency Management Agency at Flood Insurance Laws. Next is the Coastal Barrier Resources Act of 1982. It says coastal barriers along the Atlantic and Gulf Coast and along the shore areas of the Great Lakes of the United States and the adjacent wetlands, marshes, estuaries, inlets, and nearshore waters. And you can read the rest of that. And we're back. Barrier islands provide a buffer zone from the strong ocean currents and create estuary communities unique to the ecosystems. As Congress stated, there is not only scientific importance, but natural, recreational, scenic, historic, archaeological, cultural, and economic importance to barrier island resources. The Coastal Zone Barrier Resources Act protects places like the Florida Keys. It should be noted that Congress repeatedly states in its purpose section that the economic expenditures of human habitation on coastal barrier islands are excessive. Subsection 1B talks about commercial species of fish and shellfish. Subsection 2 talks about economic importance, which can include scenic stops and recreational activities influencing tourism and tourism dollars. Subsection 3 mentioned hurricanes and storm damage. Need I mention September 2004 or the destruction of New Orleans in 2005? Subsection 4 states directly the expenditure of millions of tax dollars each year due to the loss of barrier resources. And Section B twice references federal revenue expenditures. Remember the old adage, money talks. So take a look at this picture here. This is a hotel on the barrier island of Pensacola Beach, Florida, before Hurricane Ivan. Take a look after. Notice how much of the roofs are gone. Also, all the grass and the pool too. It's difficult to see, but all of the windows are gone, as well as the patios that were suspended from the walls of this particular hotel. Next is the Fish and Wildlife Coordination Act of 1934. It authorizes the Secretary of the Interior to not only protect wildlife resources, but to provide for public hunting and fishing areas as well, to make surveys and investigations of the wildlife of the public domain, including lands and waters or interests therein acquired or controlled by any agency of the United States, to accept donations of land and money for wildlife resource protection. English version. It authorizes the Secretary of the Interior to create wildlife conservation and rehabilitation plans, as well as authorize hunting of overabundant species. Wildlife conservation shall receive equal consideration and be coordinated with other features of water resource development programs. It also creates the National Wildlife Refuge System. Although the first National Wildlife Refuge, Pelican Island in Sebastian, Florida, was established in 1903 by executive order of President Theodore Roosevelt. One of my favorite questions, guys. Got to know where the blue goose comes from. So the Secretary of the Interior must make surveys of all wildlife on public lands. How does this protect wetlands? Well, Everglades National Park is a public land, and the federal government has to monitor not only the wildlife species on those lands, but also abide by the Endangered Species Act to protect the habitats of the endangered species found there. Note how these pieces of legislation work together. And now to assuage my trivia needs, Section 668DD of the Fish and Wildlife Coordination Act created the National Wildlife Refuge System. The two closest refuges to PBSC's main campus are the Arthur R. Marshall Loxahatchee National Wildlife Refuge in Boynton Beach and the Hope Sound National Wildlife Refuge in, of course, Hope Sound. So we now go to the Clean Water Act, Section 404. There is always the Federal Water Pollution Control Act, known better as the Clean Water Act. Section 404 of the CWA is one that specifically applies to wetlands. I mentioned this particular section in Section 4, but it is always worth going back over it to see how it impacts wetlands specifically. Pause and read. And we're back. In English, this means the Corps may issue permits for putting dredged or fill material into navigable waters. But notice that public hearings on the proposed permit must happen, and the Corps has discretion on whether or not to grant the permit. The Secretary of the EPA is the one who decides where dredged materials may be dumped. The Secretary is told to take into account municipal water supplies, shellfish beds, fishery areas, wildlife, and recreational areas when making such decisions. And the permits are for 5-year periods. The Secretary of the Army, acting through the Chief of Engineers, i.e. the Army Corps of Engineers, can issue permits allowing the dumping of dredged or fill material into navigable waters at specified disposal sites. The EPA administrator is the one who determines where the disposal sites are to be located and also whether or not a disposal site should be closed. It is interesting to note that public comment is required for issuing a permit, opening a dumping site, or closing a dumping site. What's the big deal with moving dredge material? An example of a badge dredge concept would be peeling up the material at the bottom of Lake Okeechobee and dumping it into Florida Bay directly. Lake Okeechobee contains a lot of phosphorus due to agricultural runoff over a great many years. If you dredge up the phosphorus-rich sediment and dump it into Florida Bay, you introduce a high concentration of phosphorus into the bay, which will produce a detrimental impact upon the organisms living there. Think massive algal bloom. Good thing no one is planning this concept. We have the Federal Migratory Bird Treaty Act of 1918. So there's a treaty about flying birds? Why do we need this? Well, It put an end to the commercial trade in birds and their feathers. By the end of the 1800s, many native bird species were devastated. It was decreed that all migratory birds and their parts, including eggs, nests, and feathers, were fully protected. Wetlands are major habitat for migratory birds, and it makes it harder to destroy existing wetlands. So this image is from the Friends of Maine Seabirds Islands. In the late 1800s, the fashion industry posed an additional threat to the bird's existence. Women's hats were decorated with feathers, egrets, herons, and terns were especially popular and therefore were the species most harmed by the trend. I mean, they would put the entire bird on a hat. Next is the Water Resources Development Act. Now, the Water Resources Development Act, or WRDA, of 2000 had a significant impact on wetlands protection and restoration, especially in South Florida. WRDA 2000 authorized a lot of projects in South Florida for Everglades restoration. Now, it is important to keep in mind that while projects might receive authorization, actual movement on projects or enforcement of some laws is dependent on whether or not funding is granted, i.e. appropriations money, are different than mere congressional authorization. In budgets over the last 15 or so years, there have been numerous cuts, and WRDA projects are often high on the cut list. Since 2000, there have been four additional WRDA acts passed by Congress: 2007, 2014, 2020, and 2022. Now, even though I just said that WRDA has only been updated four times by bills called WRDA, different provisions of the law have been updated through legislation called something other than the Water Resources Development Act. For instance, the Water Infrastructure Improvements for the Nation Act of 2016, Public Law 114-322, was signed into law by President Obama on December 16, 2016, and made changes to water resources development, i.e. provisions of WRDA in the United States Code. But since the official name of this act was not WRDA, you will not find it if you run a search for Water Resources Development Act. WRDA authorizes a number of projects and studies to rehabilitate water resources across the United States. Some examples are White River Basin in Arkansas and Missouri, Delaware River Mainstream and Channel Deepening in Delaware, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania, Sagamore Creek in New Hampshire, John Day Pool in Oregon and Washington, San Antonio Channel, San Antonio, Texas. Why is this law so important to us specifically? Because Section 601 of WRDA 2000 is the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan, or SERP. This section contains a number of projects and studies directly for the development, conservation, and restoration of the nation's water resources. It includes initial projects for SERP. By the way, the 2022 Congress proposed and passed the WRDA 2022 in July. It took a few months to resolve the differences between the House bill and the Senate bill. It was presented to President Biden on December 22, 2022, and he signed it into law on December 23rd, and it became Public Law number 117-263, and that is a live link to the language. So, SERP components. There are several elements designed to capture, store, and treat water to allow for discharges that better mimic the natural system. Portions of the managed system will be decompartmentalized to remove barriers to sheet flow. So if you take a look here to what the current flow is, and then we have what the flow plan is trying to become. Projects along the East Coast, such as ASR and water reuse, will be used for urban water supplies. Here are some of the SERP components. We've got aquifer storage and recovery, surface water storage reservoir, stormwater treatment areas, the reuse of wastewater, seepage management, removing barriers to sheet flow, operational changes. And these ones that are circled potentially impact wetlands. Okay, so what about Florida? Does the state of Florida have legal protections for wetlands? Why, yes indeed. There's mitigation for wetland destruction in Florida, in Florida statute section 373.4135. Mitigation banks and offsite regional mitigation should emphasize the restoration and enhancement of degraded ecosystems and the preservation of uplands and wetlands as intact ecosystems rather than the alteration of landscapes to create wetlands. One of the interesting things about Florida law is the extensive mitigation program set up. The Florida Mitigation Program covers not only state lands, but also private lands. This is the setup for creating human-made wetlands to offset impacts upon natural wetlands. When looking at the language, note the legislature is saying that you cannot create a wetland any old place in Florida. If one wasn't there before in the history of Florida, then you can't build one in that spot. If a person is looking for a mitigation site, has to choose between a slash pine forest 70 feet above sea level or an area filled in for population expansion but never used, that is 20 feet above sea level, which would they have to choose according to Florida statutes? It's the 20 feet above sea level, guys. If you ever find yourself on the west side of the state, the University of South Florida Tampa campus, my alma mater, created a human-made wetland to mitigate the creation of the golf course just off campus. This human-made wetland is persistently monitored and cared for to prevent it from failing. They do a lot of science projects there. By the way, just for trivia, the highest elevation in Florida is 345 feet above sea level in Lakewood, Florida, located in Walton County in the Panhandle. The mean elevation is only 100 feet. Please note, I love asking the mitigation question because it just fascinates me. So in general, why should we care about wetlands? Well, wetlands are natural filtration systems. Wetlands are located at freshwater, saltwater intermix areas, e.g. where the river meets the sea. Another quick trivia for those who might recognize the phrase, where the river meets the sea, it is a song from Animate Otter's Jug Band Christmas, directed by Jim Henson. All right, so wetlands assist in delineating a barrier area to prevent too much saltwater intrusion into freshwater areas. Wetlands provide holding areas for water and atmospheric moisture. For instance, the Aral Sea, located between Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, has been shrinking due to siphoning of water from the sea for water-intensive crops in a geographically arid region. The wetlands on the edges of the sea have been desiccated and are now non-existent, resulting in more rapid desertification of the area. Here are pictures. And this is just recently in the last 20 years. So we've got 2000, we've got 2008, and 2018. These are all from NASA's Earth Observatory System. The irrigation project began in the mid-1900s, and by 1960, the sea had already begun to dry out. Water was diverted from the Amu Darya and the Sir Darya rivers feeding the Aral to irrigate millions of acres of land for cotton and rice production in Central Asia. From 1973 to 1988, the Aral dropped from 4th to 8th among the world's largest lakes. At the start of the series in 2000, the lake was already a fraction of its 1960s extent. So you can see there's a bit of a yellow line on here. All right. The North Aral Sea, sometimes called the Small Aral Sea, had separated from the Large or South Aral Sea. As the Aral Sea has dried up, fisheries and the communities that depended on them collapsed. The increasingly salty water became polluted with fertilizer and pesticides. The blowing dust from the exposed lake bed, contaminated with agricultural chemicals, became a public health hazard. The salty dust blew off the lake bed and settled onto fields, degrading soils. Croplands had to be flushed with larger and larger volumes of river water. The loss of the moderating influence of such a large water body made winters colder and summers hotter and drier. In a last-ditch effort to save some of the lake, Kazakhstan built a dam between the northern and southern parts of the Aral Sea. The Kok Aral Dam and Dike, finished in 2005, separates the two water bodies and prevents flow out of the North Aral into the larger elevation South Aral. The dam has led fisheries in the North Aral to rebound, even as it limited flow to the South Aral. In September 2014, the New York Times ran an article about the state of things in the area of the Aral Sea. If you're interested in learning a bit more, here is the link to the article. Now, you may be wondering why I just went through this information on the Aral Sea. Why look at this lake in between Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan? Back in 1993, for my honors thesis at the University of South Florida, I decided to look at how wetlands were or were not being protected by treaties and laws. I, of course, looked at the Everglades, but I needed to look internationally. I looked at the Aral Sea. I have been tracking the demise of this area for 30 years now. Today, it is almost totally gone. The next class will deal with Everglades specifically and the law, and there will be a midterm review.